The views expressed on the following show may not be those of the hosts, guests, or WSPN Skidmore Radio. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless expressed written approval is given. Now, here are the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and a Saratoga All-Star.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Saratoga. Today is a beautiful April the 2nd. And as I said before, at the beginning of our music show, I'm glad we've got April 1st behind us, All Fool's Day. Sometimes the pranks that can be played can kind of go too far. I dislike April Fool's Day, but there are some fun things you can do that are pretty simple. I had first I want to welcome our guest, Sue Beebe, who is the assistant director at the Saratoga County Cooperative Extension.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be here today.
Well, Sue, I'm glad you are, too, because it's been a while.
And, it has.
My gosh, I think last June you were on, and we used to have you on about three or four times a year with the change of seasons, but we'll get back into that routine.
That's right.
Because it's always fun to have you on. But I had a... I was talking about April Fool's Day, and sometimes it can get out of hand,
but some of them can be really fun.
Some of them can be really fun. One that got out of hand yesterday was, I drive school bus for upstate. We transport special needs kids. So the buses were going out in the morning. We go out different times, but this happened to be about 6 o'clock. And one of the drivers goes down, gets halfway down the driveway and calls in and says, "I think my engine's on fire." He said, "My engine's smoking." So the mechanics go rushing out with fire extinguishers, and I'm sure their heart was beating 100 miles an hour, and they go down, and he said, "April Fools." So that kind of took it a little bit too far. But I had a cute one up at the school. One of the aides came out, and she says, we were talking about April Fool's Day, and she says, "I hate it because people just do the craziest things, and sometimes they don't tell you the truth." And so she goes, "Do you have any brown tan construction paper at home?" And I said, "Geez, I don't know why." And she goes, "Well, cut out a bunch of bees and put them in a little box and cover them with foil, and go when you go back to work, ask somebody if they want some brownies." So I said, "Oh, okay." And she goes, and they open, there's a box of bees, tan bees. But anyway, those are kind of cute. But
I do like that one.
Yeah,
that is good.
The big ones are kind of crazy.
So, but even the corporations get into it these days and do weird things. Yeah. I think a couple of years ago where Burger King did the big chocolate Whopper.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, really? No. Oh, my goodness.
And, introducing a new thing. And
how many people, chocolate lovers, went in there asking for a chocolate Whopper and ended up coming out with a cheeseburger?
It's always, there are some fun ones.
There are some fun ones. But I think when you get serious or personal, it can be kind of, get carried away. But anyway, Cooperative Extension, we have one. I know I was talking to you when I was talking to you about being on the show. We were talking about the Gypsy Moth, and you informed me that there's a new name for little critters.
And it is no longer the Gypsy Moth. Okay. So when you hear somebody talking about the Spongy Moth and Spongy Moth Control, that is the new name of the Gypsy Moth. Scientifically, they came up with that name based on what the egg mass is like.
Okay.
When the eggs are freshly laid. And it really is. It's very, very spongy because of the coating over top of them. So scientifically, that is the new name for it, thinking that that will make it, more representative of what the insect itself really is.
Sure.
So we do expect a continuation of the problem that we had last year. The winter wasn't as harsh as it really would need to have been to really control a lot of it. by killing off any of the egg masses. Now, some egg masses are gone. Some egg masses have been destroyed with some of the weather this year. You know, so not everything that you're seeing, you know, within your trees as you look outside, you know, is going to be problematic. But on the other hand, the normal realm for, you know, this insect is, you know, usually 3 years of peak activity before it really wanes. So last year was only year one. So I do anticipate this year we will still have a big problem. But what can help us is if we have a wetter spring. Last year, our spring was very dry. Mm-hmm. And so the natural controls, there are natural bacteria and fungus that is available to control this insect. And they're really, it's activated with moisture. And so if we have a wetter spring, it's likely that a lot of those natural controls will be there. Toward the end of the season last year, we started to see them kick in. So we know that they're within the area. We know that the, you know, the bacteria and the fungi are actually really here. It's just a matter of getting them activated.
Let me ask you a question for those who may be buying a home for the first time and never paid much attention to this. What do they look like and what damage do they do to trees if that's the only vegetation that they destroy?
Okay, well, they will. Yeah. They feed on trees and shrubs. So their preference for food is actually an oak. When an oak is done, if there's some other types of things in the area that would be more palatable for them, for instance, if you, like at my house, if you happen to have blueberries growing, they really would love those as a almost a next best scenario. But they'll also be in, you know, your maples, your lindens, you know, they go for a variety of different deciduous trees and shrubs. Evergreens is where the concern comes in because they can actually kill an evergreen in 1 year.
Really?
If the population is big enough. You can get enough, you know, evergreens, unlike our deciduous. Our deciduous, this insect comes out in May, feeds on that new growth, but the tree typically has enough energy to re-leaf. Okay. When it re-leafs, it's going to be a very small canopy leaf, but enough that it can, you know, carry on photosynthesis and store food for the next season. Evergreens don't have that choice. Mm-hmm. Once that new growth is munched, that's it, and there is no coming back from that. So if they continue back into the older growth, we have seen situations where evergreens can be killed in one season.
That's terrible. Now, what do they look like when they're in a tree or in a shrub or
There really isn't anything to distinguish them, you know, because they don't make any webs. They don't do anything along that line. They're just this caterpillar that, you know, is up there munching away. It really prefers to eat later in the day. It doesn't like heavy sun, so it likes, you know, it feeds more toward that late day into, you know, early evening. Of course, whatever it munches, you know, what goes in must come out.
Right.
And so what you may hear is things that sound like rain when you get the droppings from them as they're feeding. Their excrement just keeps falling, and it can really sound like rain.
Now, they don't give off methane gas, do they?
They don't.
So they don't add to, to what is supposed to be the, okay. What are the, we'll get back to this in a second here, but what are the webs in the trees with the worms in it?
Those are tent caterpillars. The ones that occur in the spring of the year are tent caterpillars. And they really only are problematic in fruit trees. Okay. They're really not a problem for our other ornamentals. It's really our fruit trees. So yeah, I mean, they can be a problem within our flowering crabs, our flowering plums. So they do go get into what trees that we may be having on our property as ornamentals. But they don't get into, you know, the maples, the oaks, the lindens, okay, you know, all of those. In the fall of the year, well, not fall, it's really in the late summer, you know, in August or September, when you start to see these webs along the ends of a branch, That's from the insect known as the fall webworm.
Okay.
And once, and you know, where our spring insects that are leaf eaters, you know, our tent caterpillars, our spongy moth, even cankerworm, those are, eat the new foliage, can cause, you know, some real devastation, you know, appearance to trees for a while they're getting ready to leaf out. The fall webworm, even though it has this unsightly web at the end of a branch, it really does not cause any damage to the plant because it's the end of the season. And okay. So, you know, it's really not a problem. It's just aesthetically people don't like it.
Sure.
So we really don't want you to go out there and start cutting out all the webs and doing all of that. The weather would destroy the webs and take care of them over time.
All right. So,
and
this
so it's
is,
not a problem.
This is the late fall or the end of summer. Don't go cutting your tree all the heck to get rid of them.
Right.
It's not like the gypsy moths where they may not get killed off over the winter, depending on the severity of it.
Yeah, you know, the fall webworms, I mean, all of these insects are going to, are out there laying eggs, and those eggs are already there, and they're, you know, going to occur whenever they're going to occur. You know, so you're not, it's not like you're going to eradicate it. Even by cutting out those webs, you're not going to really eradicate, you know, the insect itself. It's probably already left the webbing by the time you decide to cut it out, and it's already left, you know, laid its egg masses on a different portion of the tree. So, you know, realistically, you know, they're not really a thing of concern because they don't do any long-term harm. The spring feeders, those are the ones that can do the long-term harm. So even the tent caterpillars can, you know, but once again, you just need to know where it is, what's happening. And honestly, some of the best means of control for a tent caterpillar would be to just go in, use something to break that web open early in the day, spray an insecticide with into that web because they're going to be congregated right in that web area, and it's very easy to control them.
Early in the day, that's the best time to do it.
Right.
Now, I was just going to ask you, what is a control that people can use? I know a lot of people today don't like spraying pesticides on trees. And I remember in Saratoga, when I first moved up here and my wife was from Saratoga, they used to go down the street, the city, and spray all the trees. And that probably eliminated half the population in Saratoga over time because you were breathing all that. You know, they didn't know any different back then. No. But is there, I mean, as far as a pesticide control, is there anything you can use that's not very damaging?
Yeah, there is a BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. It is that bacteria that's naturally occurring in the soil. Okay. You can actually utilize it, and you know, following the applications there, depending upon what the weather conditions are, sometimes you can apply some of it just to the soil area. Other ones really need to be sprayed up into the tree. I am going to say it's probably going to be hard to get your hands on BT this year because there is a great call because the spongy moth population has been so big.
Yeah.
You may have to, you know, mail order it to try to get it because locally you might not be able to find it. You know, but that really is your best biological control. You know, you can definitely do the tree wraps, you know, as this insect, see, the whole history behind the spongy moth was it was brought here believing it was a silkworm.
Oh, okay.
And so when they brought it over from Europe, they thought it was a silkworm. We thought we were going to have this great population, and it ended up it was not the moth they thought it was. Now, it does form a silken strand,
yeah,
which helps it to drop from the top of the tree down to the ground for the day where it can hide under a rock or something else before it crawls back up to feed. And that's why using those bands, whether it's a band of duct tape around the tree or whether it's, you know, putting a nice band of burlap that they can hide under until it's time for them to move up. These are places where you can help capture them and okay, prevent them from going back up in the tree. So the key is to have that kind of stuff ready as the eggs hatch, you know, so that you can catch them while they're really young before they get up there to do anything. And understand, a lot of those egg masses are way high in the canopy right now.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I can look out my back window and, you know, I have one oak that's just, and it's ironic because it's not the one that was totally defoliated last year, but it has more egg masses on it, you know, and most of the egg masses occur over 12 feet on the tree. So there's no way to go out and scrape those off now or do any of that, which will help control the population. So anything within reach, you could scrape off. And when you're scraping it off, you've got to collect them. You can't just scrape them to the ground. They're just going to hatch anyway.
All right.
You need to collect them and then destroy them. And you need to destroy them by putting them into, you know, a bucket of soapy water.
Okay.
And that will kill them off. And, you know, and then you can just, you know.
Good old soapy water.
Yeah. You know, soapy water is pretty good.
Yeah, you spray your indoor plants for aphids. You use soapy water.
Yep.
Hey, listen, you're listening. I was going to say listen here. But you're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM Skidmore Radio. And if you want to call up and ask Sue any questions, 518-580-5783, 580-5783 is our number in the studio, and you feel free to ask any questions. Sue, I know my wife was walking through the state park, and she saw some of this. Of course, she was on the phone about 5 feet away from me yelling out a question to ask you, which is always very confusing to me when I'm trying to hear the other person on the other side talk. But and you know, she was saying that she goes through the state park and she thinks she sees indication of that. And I know I was taken aback when you said they call them spongy moth, because I thought maybe the gypsies were protesting that they had something bad named after them. So, but it probably is better to call them what they are and identify them, you know, because gypsy moth, you think they're in a caravan and they're gonna hop out, and they don't do that. So
no, they don't. They stay right there. Yeah. So.
Now, you know, when you mentioned duct tape, it just brought something to my mind, which is amazing. Duct tape.
Oh, we really miss having Len in for that one.
I know, really. I'll tell you, we used to bounce off each other pretty good, you know.
He would have had something good to say.
He would have. And I do miss him. He's alive and well, but living a little ways away, but I do miss him. They make duct tape now in different colors.
They do.
You don't have to have that silver band around the tree. You know, you can have black to match a little better, or even brown they make.
They have camouflage.
Oh, they do.
They do.
Oh, man. I see the orange duct tape. I mean, they have every color of duct tape now.
You can do just about anything.
That's right. You know? Anything your little heart desires, you know.
No.
All right. So there's so many different, types of worms. You know, we talked about four or five of them. Now, if someone was unsure, could they take a picture and send it to the Cooperative Extension to find out?
Give us a shout out. You can email it to us, you know, or, you know, if you happen to be, you know, out there and you can reach, you know, at the office when somebody's, you know, there, you know, you could then just potentially even just text it to us.
Yeah.
So yes, you know, we'll be happy to take a look at it to identify which one of those spring feeders it might happen to be. You know, the clearer the picture, of course, the better.
Oh, sure. So it's better to climb the tree, get right up next to it with your phone.
You don't have to worry, because all of them are eventually at some point going to be low enough that you can actually get good photos of them.
Hey, why don't we give the email address out?
Okay. So it would be best actually if you just would email them directly to me. That would be the better thing. And so that's skb11@cornell.edu.
Okay.
So it's a very simple email.
Yeah. And do you have the phone number at the tip of your tongue?
It would be 518-885-8995.
And if you didn't catch the email address, you can always call the extension office, and they'll tell you what to do.
Yeah, or even if you just hop onto our website, ccesaratoga.org, you can, you know, email us directly from that website as well. You can either send a direct email to a person or just send it to our generic email on the website. And, you know, Ellie will definitely get it to us.
So. Okay. I know she screens the calls very, very good. Oh, my gosh, trying to get through to you is like trying to get through to the president of Amazon.
You know, it's so nice having a live receptionist, though, so it that is. You actually have someone to talk to.
Oh, my gosh. You don't know. Yeah. And, you know, none of this push one or in Spanish do this or yeah, it's rare these days to talk to a live person.
Yeah, no.
And no, it's nice. And, you know, so give a call if you don't know what that mass in your tree is, or you notice foliage disappearing, or your evergreens are starting to lose that nice light colored green.
You know, the key to the control is really making sure that you're actually doing something early on. And that's why I say, you know, putting the bands around the trees even before the, egg masses hatch. The hatch is something that we really can't predict exactly when it's going to be, because it's really kind of up to Mother Nature. And you saw from this week's weather, who knows what that really is.
Yeah. And we don't fool around with Mother Nature.
No. So, you know, that hatch could start anywhere from, you know, the last week of April, you know, to the last week of May. You don't really know when that's going to occur. Yeah. And that's what makes it, you know, a little tough. Because it all just depends upon how quickly we really do warm up.
Okay. Question I wanted to ask you, and I would assume this would have been one of Lynn's questions. Locusts in the summertime when it's hot, can they predict when it's going to get hotter? No.
No. They can.
That was the old story when we were kids. You would hear those, oh, my gosh, it's going to get hotter. Hey, you know, it'd be 90 degrees out, and, you know, we thought it'd. You hear them buzz, and so they can't predict.
No, they can't.
Okay, all right. So let's talk. We're now into spring, and the snow gets off of the lawns and flower beds and the perennial gardens, and people are out there as soon as the grounds unfreeze, you know, and they're raking away. And they're digging up all this grass. And is that good for lawns? And people get like, what do you call it? Spring fever.
Absolutely.
And they want to get right out there because they feel good being outside and that.
It depends upon what the situation really is that you've really got going. If your ground is still semi-frozen, it's really best not to be doing anything. If the ground has thawed around that surface area, you're not doing any harm raking it.
Okay.
Okay. But you don't really want to be raking on frozen ground.
Okay.
We really don't, you know, so, I mean, there is a lot of areas that still have frozen ground.
Oh, sure.
And one of the things is, if you have a very thin lawn and you're out there and you've definitely got it so that the ground isn't frozen and you can rake up an area, if you're looking to overseed, and especially if you're looking to overseed with Kentucky bluegrass, doing it before that soil temperature reaches over 50 degrees is really the best time in this, you know. Of course, our best time to seed is really, you know, late August through September. So when you miss that window, when you've got those soil temperatures that are, you know, cooler to really allow that germination, that's the reason that we really kind of want to do it early in the spring. Kentucky bluegrass is the one that really germinates best when that soil temperature, you know, is actually slightly below 50 degrees.
Okay.
So if that's what you're seeding with, you know, getting out there on a thawed soil, raking the area, and then put down some of that seed, it's advisable. You know, if you're going to be using a blend that's not, doesn't have a lot of Kentucky blue, but is mainly a rye or a fescue, it's not as soil soil temperature dependent.
Okay.
So it really doesn't matter when you're going to be doing it. We find that the germination is basically the same regardless of, you know, under 50 or over 50 for soils.
All right, so now wouldn't be a bad time.
So now for would a not be a either. Bad time.
All right. You know, I have a problem in our yard, and we live in a development, so it's not like out in the country, but I overseed the lawn, and then I got a flock of birds out there eating the seed, and I don't know if it's doing any good to overseed or, you know.
Well, that is one of the problems with spring seedings, and that's one of the reasons we really encourage people to actually seed between August 15th and September 15th. Your birds have lots more food to feed on, and they really could care less about your grass seed.
Sure.
And so they really avoid it at that point. In the spring of the year, that's one of the prime things. That's a prime food source for them. They don't have that other food available to them. And so, therefore, you know, they're going to come and get that with, unless you're going to mulch over top of that seeding.
That's
you
hard
know, and
to
if
do.
You're doing an overseeding, you really don't really want to be mulching because you've got established grasses.
Sure.
You know, so there really is not any way to really prevent them from going ahead and eating away. And that does remind me of one thing. We do have the problem right now with the avian flu within birds.
Yes.
And so if you're around an area or you have backyard chicken flock on your own property, you should not be feeding the birds. You should okay. put your bird feeders away. Because you don't want to draw them in. A lot of your wild birds can carry this influenza. They will have no symptoms, but that is going to bring them onto your property and, you know, potentially cause the loss of the flock that you have. And this is a very, very serious disease. If your flock goes down, one bird goes down, legitimately, the entire flock needs to be killed.
We're talking chickens.
We need chickens, okay. turkeys.
Okay.
The entire flock would need to be killed off.
I know we've lost so many chickens had to be euthanized back maybe a month ago. We're talking about in the millions.
It is still very, very hot. And we do have it in Saratoga County.
Oh, we do.
So don't believe we don't, because we do. It has been, you know, detection of it.
And we got a lot of turkey farms. I mean, and a lot of chicken. That's a terrible thing. But now we have 4 bird feeders out in our backyard, but we don't have any poultry around, so you know, I think we're set there, but I know that's a very dangerous
you know, folks that are out more in a more country setting versus a more enclosed neighborhood, those are the ones that you really need to be more cognizant of your neighbors, because there are a lot of, you know, small flocks that are around. And, you know, so that's why I really would encourage people not to have bird feeders up within those areas, so that you aren't drawing in the, you know, the extra birds right now as they're starting to migrate back.
Sure. Now, are humans susceptible to
catching? No,
they
are not.
They are not. So it's strictly
an avian.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about planting grass seed, you know, in the spring as compared to April or August to September. I found when I had my landscaping business years ago that you have more moisture in the air, too, in the summer and fall. And, you know, when it's humid out, and that helps the lawn. You know, if you water it early in the morning and overnight, you're still getting moisture from that humidity.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It actually is the best time, but we know that a lot of people, you know, it gets ingrained in people's minds. Spring is the growth, you know, you've got that new growth that's coming. And so people just don't think about doing something, you know, toward the end of the growing season. And so we do get a lot of new lawns that people are trying to put in the spring. And that is tougher, because you definitely have to be mulching, because otherwise you are going to have that loss to birds. And a lot of our spring storms of rain are harsher They're not more gentle as we typically would have in that late season rain. They're usually a gentler rain. But in the spring, we get a lot of the thunderstorms, a lot of the rushing water. And that becomes a real situation for us because you're going to get a lot of, you know, run of the seed as well. So you may, you know, have seed going into one area. You may get a great lush lawn in one section. And you know, a whole other area is not going to have even a drop of grass.
Right. And, too, I think you have to water a lot more in the spring, you know, to try and get that established faster because of the heavier rains, you know. So, yeah, but, you know, I think people, too, want a nice lawn before August. And, you know, so they're doing a lot more stuff in the spring, you know.
Yeah.
And I know there's times, we've talked about this before, there's times of the year that you should fertilize. And I know you always say they're before like some holidays, you can usually pin the times to fertilize. Why don't you give us
You know, and depending upon what your lawn really is, what type of grasses you have, most lawns do not need excessive amount of fertilization. The big key is you should be returning clippings and not bagging.
Okay.
Because as you return your clippings are water and nutrients. So it not only supplies nutrients to the soil, which really returning your clippings will give you about 1 pound of nitrogen. Okay, so when we're talking about fertilizing lawns, we typically talk about how much pounds of N we want to be putting down. So at a fertilization, you know, we really should not put down more than about a half a pound of N at a time. You know, if we're returning our clippings for the realm of that entire growing season, we've added a whole pound of N per 1,000 square feet. So we've already done a lot of fertilization just by returning our clippings. So, you know, if you're talking a general grass mix, fertilizing 2 times a year and returning your clippings is really what you would need to do to maintain a good lawn. If we're talking Kentucky bluegrass lawns, they are going to require more fertilization.
Okay, but still return the clippings.
But still return the clippings. So as far as our seasonalities of when we want to do it, we do. We like to talk holiday, Memorial Day, Labor Day. Those are your 2 times.
Okay.
Not late April. You don't want to be really fertilizing until the grass has had a chance to really begin growing.
Sure.
So in reality, a fertilizer should not go down until after you've made at least 2 mowings before you fertilize. So typically, that's going to be closer to Memorial Day.
So no Easter fertilizer,
people. No Easter fertilizer, no. You know, so it's Memorial Day and then Labor Day, you know, early September. Sure. Is your other prime time. Those are the prime times. You know, if you're in a situation where you've got a lawn that's, you know, been around for 25 years and all you're doing is returning clippings, but you might need a little extra boost, the first time to fertilize is really that September fertilization.
Okay.
Because that's the fertilization that's key, because what happens there is it returns enough nutrients to encourage the roots to grow deeper. And then they're able to pull in more moisture and actually survive through the winter better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key fertilization. So, and there are a lot of lawns out there that, you know, as long as you're returning clippings all the time and they're well established and it's a good, you know, thick turf, that you don't need additional fertilizations for them.
And that helps too, I think, when it's hot and dry in the summertime. Because you have established roots, the lawn is thicker, and the sun really doesn't get down to burn everything off. Some lawns will go dormant in the summer.
Some will.
And but, you know, one thing I found out, too, is that if you do return your clippings, you'll want to mow when the grass is not short, but you don't want it to get too tall because then you'll have big clods of grass all over, and that's not good either.
Yeah, no, you don't want to, you know, cut so much, let it go so long that when you're cutting your, that your clippings are going to smother versus naturally just decompose really rapidly. So that really is a key for you there. But the other thing that we really want to encourage people to do is to mow their lawns a little higher. I still see a lot of people mowing at 2 inches, and then they're out there trying to, you know, 2 or 3 times a year, trying to put something down to get rid of those weeds. Raise the mower height, go to 3 inches, and you won't have to be out there using herbicides, because right. just the height of the grass will shade the ground and prevent those weeds from growing. So, you know, mowing higher is really kind of a key avenue for folks. So we really need to get away from that, you know, cutting
golf
short,
course,
you know, it's not,
yeah, we
really don't want to be doing that for, and our grasses that we utilize, our cool season grasses that we utilize for lawns in this area really don't like to be cut short. Right. You know, that's not what they like. They like to be able to establish a good root system.
And you'll get a lot of burnout in the summertime. I mean, it's, more grass, the thicker your grass gets, it'll choke out weeds too, correct?
Correct.
I mean, you know, you mow too short, you get bare lawn in the summer, and you're going to get that crab grass popping up, and you know, it looks green, but, you know, it's kind of tough, because that'll choke out grass.
Yeah.
So don't fertilize if you have to fertilize until Memorial Day. You can overseed any time of the year, but the best time is August through the end of September. Correct?
It's the best time to establish
a new lawn. Okay.
You know, I mean, you can do overseeding at that time too, but you can do overseeding now in the spring of the year.
Okay.
But it's now. It's like, you know, don't put off your overseeding to the end of May. You know, overseeding would be something that we could do now.
Okay. Now, in the spring, should people thatch their lawn if they think the thatch is built up too high? Or
most homes will not ever really build up a heavy thatch layer.
Okay.
Because most homes probably have a mix of grasses. Folks who have heavy Kentucky bluegrass, those are the homes that are really going to have to concentrate on dethatching.
Okay.
Because Kentucky bluegrass, being a total rhizomatous grass, really forms a dense thatch layer, you know, as the grasses progress over time. Most other grasses really don't, you know, you don't accumulate a heavy thatch layer. And so a lot of other mixes, you may never have to dethatch. And so it's the Kentucky bluegrass lawns that really need that dethatching. And you need to do that when we've got ample soil moisture, but not wet soils.
Okay.
You don't want to be dethatching on dry soils.
All right.
Yeah, no. But you also don't want it to be really, really soggy wet either.
Yeah, because it'll bring up a lot. And you got to keep that thatcher moving, because it will be like a rototiller if you keep it in one spot too long. And that's not good either. You know, nitrogen is good for lawns. I had always heard, and I could be wrong, that when we get a thunderstorm, that puts nitrogen into the atmosphere and can help plants that are nitrogen lovers. Is there any truth to that, or is that an old wives' tale?
Actually, there is some truth to that, yes.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of different activation that can occur, and a lot of rains can bring a lot of different things to life and a lot of nutrients along with them. And so that definitely, you know, is a, you know, it does play into the role of what you really want to have.
Okay, so stay inside during a lightning and thunderstorm, but you just think that it's helping your plants.
That's exactly right.
So,
you know,
be safe, and everything will work out fine. Hey, right now I want to read a public service announcement when I can get to my public service announcement page. So let's go with this. A lot of these still have to do with COVID, and that's kind of reducing now a little bit. I know there's another variant coming through, which I don't.
And I heard that Warren County's numbers, they doubled in a week.
Did they really?
Yeah.
See, I don't think we're, my personal opinion, and I know I was talking to my doctor about this, I don't think it's ever going away. I think there's always going to be a variant that we have to watch out for. And the boosters and that may help it a little bit, but it can't fight the new variant because they haven't, you know, tested and come up with I don't know. I just think that this was a terrible, terrible virus or strain in the original. And I know they say that it weakens over time, but I'll tell you, it may be a little bit, but there's still people that are, are passing away from it. I lost a cousin about a month ago who I was talking with his wife, and she said that I said, did he have a problem, you know, underlying condition? She goes, the only medicine that he took, he was late 60s. It was my mother's cousin. The only medicine he ever took was a vitamin C every day. He was the picture of health, and he had all his shots, got COVID, and died 6 days later. And, you know, I mean, you just don't know.
No, you don't. Everybody's system is a little different. You never know who's going to get hit by it. And, you know.
Terrible thing.
It is.
It really is. I mean, you're afraid. I know they say don't be afraid, but a lot of, you know, I think the younger people don't think about things like this, but, you know, you don't want to go out in big crowds. I'm still a little shy about going to the movie theater, because I like to eat popcorn, and it's kind of hard with a mask on. And I tried drinking a soda one day with my mask on, driving the school bus and that, so I cut a little hole so I could put the straw through. I couldn't find the hole with the straw, and I'm poking myself all over the place. I never, needless to say, I never had a sip of soda.
Yeah.
But I want to say this, curiosity kills the cat. Kids are curious about everything, including guns. Talking to them about gun safety in your home is a good first step, but you can do more. Always keep your guns locked, unloaded, and stored separately from the ammunition. Storing your gun securely is the best way to prevent family fire, shooting fire. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. And this was brought to you by End Family Fire, Brady, and the Ad Council. And a lot of people may not know what Brady is, but that was one of President Reagan's aides who was paralyzed when someone tried to assassinate President Reagan. And Jim Brady was his name, and they created a passed legislation on gun control and named it the Brady Act. But, you know, I'm for the Second Amendment 100%, and I find no problem with youngsters learning how, I mean, not a second grader, but, you know, young people learning how to shoot guns to go hunting and that. But you do have to have some sort of safety plan in your house. And so always lock up your ammunition and guns separately, maybe on a different floor. And, you know, locked up so that, you know, you're safe. And that's all, that's with everything in life, is to be safe and take precautions. And that's why we don't drink and drive. I mean, you got to use your head and be safe. Because somebody else is going to get hurt. Not, a lot of times it's not the person that causes the problem. You're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM Skidmore Radio. The phone number in the studio is 518-580-5783. And our special guest today is Sue Beebe, the Assistant Director of Cooperative Extension. And Sue's been with us, I think, for probably the 14 years we've been on the air, and we always have a lot of fun, and we miss Lynn because, I mean, quite frankly, Lynn was our whipping boy, and we used to have a lot of fun with him, and he used to live near Sue.
That's right.
So he, you know, he was a good partner to have on the studio. Let's talk a little bit about winter damage to lawns. I know I... This is crazy. I snowplow a path, a run in the backyard for our dog because she likes to run and be chased in the wintertime, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's good exercise for her. And, you know, I mean, she doesn't like going into the snow when it's high up to her chest and that. So I do some runs and, you know, I run with her and chase her and that. What? And I always know when, like this time of the year, you can see where I've snowblown, you know, mm-hmm. the yellow and that. What? I mean, I know the lawn always comes back, but what is the damage that you can do by doing that?
Well, you're damaging the crowns. You know, you're not, you know, you're putting a lot of consistent traffic over a particular area.
Okay.
And so it damages the crowns of the grass. So they're a little slower to respond. So it is. It's going to be a yellower area, or, you know, stay tan longer.
Yeah.
Because the crowns need time to then actually respond because they've been crushed more.
Okay.
You know, where, you know, the other areas, you know, haven't had that same kind of traffic on that frozen soil that, you know, you were having in those situations. So, yeah, we do see a lot of that occurs with a lot of different, you know, dog runs. You know, that's a very common thing. And it's not uncommon for people to be snow blowing paths for their dogs. So
thank you.
You're not alone on that one,
okay.
Rick.
Thank you very much. Because when my wife, we've done this for years. But I always say, oh, my gosh, you know, the yellow, because I mow the lawn and I like a nice lawn. Yeah. You know, everybody wants a green lawn today when you wonder how they did it 150 years ago. They didn't have green lawns manicured to perfection. And we survived.
You know, nobody ever thought about bagging. Years and years ago.
Okay.
And then we came into baggers.
Mm-hmm.
And once we came into baggers, we started to see a big variation in what really happened with lawns, which just proves the fact that when you don't bag, you return right. those clippings, you have greener grasses.
Grass.
It's really there. So, if you really think about it, you know, we've really kind of, you know, we caused it ourselves with the equipment, you know, the modernization that we had over, you know, bringing in baggers. So, you know, they're good in certain circumstances mm-hmm. for certain things. You know, if you've gone away on vacation, nobody mowed the lawn and your lawn gets really long, rather than going out and cutting it in two or three sequences, which is really actually better for the lawn, a lot of people will just go out and hack it back once. Well, if you go to do that, that's the scenario we already talked about. You don't want those long clippings.
Right.
That's a time to bag. You know, but outside of that, an issue like that, you know, we really don't want to be bagging. But to be honest with you, it really would be healthier when the grass gets out of hand to, you could mow a lawn every other day and do less damage than it is by going out and cutting it once.
So raise the blade up higher and then maybe a couple of days later, a little bit lower. So that
until you bring it back to the height that you know,
and it should be, you said, 3 inches.
3 inches is really going to be a much better lawn, you know, just for the absolute health of the lawn, to make sure you don't have problems with insects, diseases, or weeds. 3 inches is been researched time and time again, has been the best mowing height.
Okay, now, when I buy a lawnmower, I buy a mulching lawnmower rather than a non-mulching lawnmower. Is that a better way to kind of get the clippings?
Well, it breaks the clippings up smaller, so therefore they break down faster. You know, it doesn't really make a difference as to whether it's a mulching or not.
Right.
Your big key is your frequency of mowing is just, you know, if you mow at the proper time, your clipping really is not going to be an issue whether you have a mulching mower or not.
Okay. And should we mow the same way every time we mow?
No, you really should be altering your patterns.
Okay.
Your big thing is you're looking to try to not, it's kind of the same problem that you have with that dog run, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you're compacting soils within that one area, you know, and a lot of people, you know, so alternate your patterns, you know, crisscross, then do a kind of a box shape.
Sure.
You know, I mean, every time you're out there, try to alter that pattern a little bit.
Sometimes I'll go start in one corner, go to the other corner, and then just mow like that way, and then east and west and north and south. So,
and then diagonally, you know, I mean, you know, just alter them up, or, and then the next time do a box. You know, you can do, you know, easily four different patterns that are really going to then stop what it is that, that really happens and help the lawn by not compressing things, you know, the same across the area. If you are constantly mowing in that same pattern, you may find that you're going to start to see insects or diseases occurring in a pattern.
Okay.
Yeah, no. And that really lets you know that you have really compacted some soils within an area.
Yeah. See, I think people, you know, should try and understand that, because almost every time you see somebody mow, it's the same way, you know. And I just kind of, by us talking over the years, that different patterns is better for the lawn.
Yeah.
And all right. So another thing this time of the year is, my gosh, it's 8:52 already on our clock.
Oh, wow.
And I can't believe it. You got to come back sooner.
Yeah. No. Well, we'll just have to pick a date.
Yeah. You're going to have to. This time of the year, people are, other than the lawns, are thinking about perennial beds and seeding perennial beds. Is this a good time of the year? I mean, people usually cut back in the fall. Is this a good time of the year to, like, add soil to the garden while the plants are small yet, rather than when they start to grow and get taller?
A couple of things that I really want. You say people usually cut back in the fall. That's one of the things we want to try to encourage people to stop doing.
Okay.
Because pollinators, a lot of our good pollinators, really can utilize some of those, you know, perennials as good winter hiding places.
Okay.
And so we really would like to really encourage people, unless there's a real absolute need to cut back in the fall, to really wait until spring to do some of those garden cleanups. You know, that's just to help your pollinators. So we got a lot of people who are very pollinator friendly these days, but they're not thinking about the fact of what that habitat needs to be. So leaving those gardens and doing a spring cleanup versus a fall cutback for pollinators is really a plus. So that's the first thing. But yes, you're right. A lot of people do cut back in the fall. And what is it that we really want to be doing? You know, spring fertilizations are really good for a takeoff of many of our perennials. But once again, people have a tendency to get out there a little too early with some of that as well. You want to make sure that your soils are really thawed, that you're really starting, and especially if you're using an organic fertilizer, your soil needs to be consistently over 50 degrees, and it's better if it's about 55 to 60 degrees.
Okay.
So you need to have a good warm soil for an organic fertilizer to actually even work. So if you're going out there now and fertilizing with an organic fertilizer, all you've done is wasted money.
All right.
It's not going to have any benefit. So your key is kind of, you know, it's a good time to clean up. You know, get out there, because you do have things that are popping now. You know, your daylilies are going to be popping. Things are going to be happening. It's time to get out there and make sure you're doing that final spring garden cleanup and do that light kind of work there. But as far as fertilizations go, if you're using a synthetic product, you can fertilize before the soils are warm. But if you're using an organic product, you really need to wait for those soils to warm up.
Okay. How about, like I said, you know, like my wife wants to add soil to the garden, because...
Yeah, you know, top dressing with a little bit of soil, you know, definitely can be beneficial, especially if you're using like a good compost or something along that line. That can be a really nice thing. Don't go too heavy, though.
Okay.
You're just looking to add a little, because it needs to naturally incorporate.
Okay. One of the things, we had more subjects to go through, and I'd like to...
we just always run out of time.
Oh, Rick. My gosh. It just goes by so blooming fast. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about, maybe if you could come back in June, because June is Dairy Month.
It is.
And I'd like to talk about, you know, dairy farming and what's going on with the 4-H programs. And maybe we can even get into some when's a good time for grub control, because we'll be getting later in June, and I think that comes up more.
That comes up
summer.
Around that time. Yeah. That's exactly right.
So maybe we can talk about that then. But I do want to recognize Dairy Month, because not only we had a girl on last year whose family owns a dairy farm in Herkimer County, and but I'd like to talk about Dairy Month because it's so important today. And you know, with everything that's going on now, and there's with farming and avian flu for poultry and that. So I'd like you to come back in June if you can. So you pick a date and then let me know, and we'll talk about the.
We can definitely do that.
Dairy farming, okay? So I appreciate you being on as always. You know, we have a lot of fun, and maybe I can even get Lynn down here. He said it when you were on to let him know, but I didn't let him because I didn't want him on today. But, you know, you can only take so much. I know, Lynn, if you're listening, I really mean it. No. April Fool's on April 2nd. But I always appreciate it. And the Cooperative Extension is a wealth of information for homeowners. You know, if you want to test your soil.
We got a lot of soils coming in right now for pH testing.
And pH testing can tell you what to put on your lawn or what your lawn needs. And you can do that by going to, you can email Sue at skb11@cornell.edu. And her the website is
saratoga.org. Right.
Okay. And seriously, it doesn't cost that much to have your soil tested.
A simple pH test is only $1 a sample. And that really tells you an awful lot.
How can you beat that? You know, I mean, for a good lawn and whatever. So right now, I want to thank you. And
well,
right now,
you.
I've got a gentleman on the left side of me who I was going to sing Strangers in the Night, but he sings that over the summer when I'm not here and fills in for me. And last week, I played the soundtrack from American Graffiti, and I threw in some of Wolfman Jack's clips that I got off the internet because he was in the movie. And to me, when I was a kid, he was one of the, I considered the best DJs because of his shows. He was a crazy man, a lot of fun, and got people involved in his shows. But I want to welcome back Homer, and Homer, it was great filling in for you.